Hello and welcome to the IntraFish podcast, where we bring you the most interesting and compelling seafood news. I'm Drew Cherry, Editor-in-Chief, joined today by Senior Business Reporter Rachel Sapin and Executive Editor John Fiorillo. We are going to be talking about a couple topics today. We will first be discussing Maine and land-based aquaculture. Some great reporting been done by Rachel and by John. And then later in the podcast, we'll be talking about climate change with Andrew Mallison. He's a consultant with FishThink, and we'll hear his thoughts on the recent heat wave and what the industry needs to do to both prepare for changing climate and make some changes in their business practices to at least not make things worse. So, Rachel, I'm going to go over to you first. We will talk about kingfish maybe more specifically because it is new, or the news around it is fresh. But land-based aquaculture has been, it's sort of found a home, or it seemed that it had found a home in Maine, the state of Maine in the U.S., and a lot of companies began looking there, citing out places to build their operations, not just salmon operations, but also, in the case of Kingfish Company, a yellowtail kingfish. Now, the Kingfish Company is a Dutch firm. It's listed on the Oslo Stock Exchange. It's a relatively new company, but it has proven to grow commercial grade yellowtail kingfish, and that product is available in major retailers, including Whole Foods in the United States. So it's a real company with real ambitions. Tell us a bit, then, Rachel. Let's start with kingfish, and then we'll work our way back about the larger issue of whether or not Maine's going to be the future of land based. But what happened this week with kingfish?
This week, Kingfish had to kind of wait out the town of Jonesport in Maine, the town where they're going to be building this project. They're like one permit away from getting it off the ground. So they're really close to their land-based facility, being able to undergo construction and become operational. But they did have to wait for the town of Jonesport. They kind of have a local government, home rule style of government. So what the town wanted to have residents vote on was whether to allow aquaculture projects in general to be in development in the town of Jonesport. It's a pretty small rural town in Maine. I think it has maybe over 1,600 residents. John, I think we looked at that. But what they do is they have a meeting, and the residents who are registered voters in Jonesport come and they vote at the meeting. Yes or no, do they want to have aquaculture projects in Maine, or do they want to put a 6-month moratorium on projects, not just kingfish, but other projects? And that moratorium was rejected by 201-91 votes. So kingfish does have pretty strong support in Jonesport, and it looks like that project is going to move forward. That's not been the case in other towns where companies operate, such as American Aqua Farms. Last year, that town pushed a similar moratorium, and the residents there approved that. So American Aqua Farms actually did have to deal with a town they were in, Goldsboro, that said they didn't want aquaculture projects at the moment in Maine, that they needed more time to have residents weigh in and consider options. So I think overall Ohad and his team have done a very good job of, you know, working with residents in Maine and really explaining what they're doing. And they've been a really standout company from my reporting in that respect.
And that's been so critical for any of these projects, is that local engagement. And no matter what the project, particularly with aquaculture, it seems like dealing with the community and dealing with a skeptical community is going to be a part of any of these projects. Now, it's, as you said, American Aqua Farms have obviously faced its hurdles. And in addition, Nordic Aqua Farms, which is also planning a project Whole Oceans also planning a project. These companies have faced headwinds as well.
Yeah, I don't know if they've faced a moratorium like Jonesport and Goldsboro or have, but yeah, Nordic Aquafarms has quite a few very vocal groups and residents that have asked for the project not to go forward there. There's been a lot more legal battles. We reported last month that Eric Heim left his role with the company early this month. And we're not quite sure what he's doing next. So there's been a lot of shakeup over there. And then with Whole Oceans, it's just been an issue of, you know, when is that project actually going to get off the ground? Because, you know, we're going into 5 years now with nothing going on over there, but lots of talk of what they could be doing. So it seems like they're facing maybe financing issues over there.
Right. Yeah. And credit has to be getting tighter. And I think these types of speculative projects are going to be increasingly difficult to go make the case for, especially in times when there's so much economic uncertainty. John, the NIMBY, not in my backyard, crowd is certainly active in across the seafood industry, and ensuring that, as I said earlier, connecting with the local residents, ensuring that happens is so important to projects. But you wrote a comment about Maine, and you question whether or not it is sort of the kind of the new home of American aquaculture that it seemed to be a few years ago.
Yeah, I after Rachel's story on the moratoriums and the increase in moratoriums in the state in these small towns, I went back and I looked at our reporting from the very beginning when these projects began to announce their development in Maine. And it was quite clear that everybody was riding high. I mean, politicians, the former governor, now senator, some of the state development associations, they were all quick to come out and talk about how this is the future. And I'm not saying it's not the future, don't get me wrong, but they were very vocal in their support. Fast forward now 4 years or so, maybe a little bit longer. They're not around, especially the politicians. You're not hearing from them at all. You know, the premise of my column was the dream in Maine is now largely a disaster. And I still feel that in the sense that I think expectations were that we would be cranking out some fish by now, even if it was small numbers, you know, that it would begin to be a robust sector there, maybe inspire more copycat kind of farms across the state. There's no fish yet. None. Zero. Zip. Absolutely none. So, you know, that was that's kind of what I, yeah, not kind of, that's what I was saying. And subsequently, Brian Vincey of the Freshwater Institute wrote a letter that we published and took me to task for it. And basically, his response was, well, John, these things take time and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And I agree. I know these things take time. I'm not stupid. But I think anybody, if you would have asked them 4 years ago when these projects started, or a little over 4 years ago, I think people would have not anticipated the slow pace of this. I just don't think they did anticipate that. And what they really didn't anticipate was the pitchfork-wielding, torch-bearing crowds of citizens coming out against them. I really do believe that they thought they were just going to roll in this with the promise of jobs, yada, 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 and Not so much. So as Rachel's reporting demonstrated, there's all these moratorium efforts going on in these small towns. And these are small towns, Rachel. You said 1,600. I think it's even less now. The newest census is something like 1,200 in Jonesport, which is fine.
Yeah,
I live in a small town. It's great. But, you know, these moratoriums, and these moratoriums, let's be clear, they're being pushed by a lobbyist group, a group that generally doesn't represent the kind of salt of the earth citizenry that you would kind of think in your mind for a small town. They're a lot of them tend to be very wealthy Mainers who want to protect their view, or, you know, whatever they want, NIMBYs, as you mentioned. So anywho, fast forward, and here we are. And it looks like OHAD and the Kingfish company may be the first to succeed in the sense that they raise a fish in Maine. I hope so. I think, I don't know what OHAD has done, but maybe the other ones ought to call them in and study it. But to this point, you know, I still say the dream is far from realized and is on the knife's edge of a complete disaster. Whole Oceans is a great example. I mean, they're running out of clock. They had a 5-year window, I think Rachel just mentioned, to kind of get all the permits, break the ground, get everything going. They're not, I don't know. It doesn't seem like they're close at all, but maybe they're closer than they're revealing.
Rachel, what do you think that OHAD Maiman, who's the CEO of Kingfish Company and his team, what do you think they did differently in Jonesport that as John said, that maybe some of the other companies could learn from?
I've just found that company has been very transparent about its process. It's done a lot of work with the university kind of Maine, I think, and kind of collaborating on different parts of the project. And I think just generally just being willing to answer questions, taking residents' concerns seriously. Because, you know, these companies are locating in small towns, so it really is important to get these towns to back a project. As we've seen, it's just, you know, it really does complicate things if residents start to get concerned about what's going to happen to their water quality or, you know, their quality of life. And those are very valid concerns that I'm sure some residents do have. So I am not quite certain what OHAD did differently, but my guess is, you know, just really taking the residents' concerns seriously and really trying to address them, you know, and work with them.
I wonder to what extent, and this is pure conjecture, but I wonder to what extent Kingfish raising a non-salmonid species, not raising salmon, has anything to do with it as well. And I say that because Maine is a state that has wild salmon, very, very few, but, and it's an issue in that state that the salmon have been in decline and have been, populations have been decimated over the years, not as a result of aquaculture, but, or even fishing, but loss of habitat primarily. And there's some very, very active groups that are trying to restore wild salmon populations in Maine. And so I'm curious about that because it certainly that there was not the same community opposition to Atlantic Sapphire, a land-based salmon farmer in Florida, to their mega project. Which to me says a couple of things. And one is, understanding culture is so important. John, you have more experience with Maine than I do. Is there anything to the character of Maine? And I can you're going to, I'm setting you up to offend a lot of people from the great state of Maine, but better you than me. So what is it about maybe the character of people in Maine or culturally that you think would be easy to overlook if you were going to establish a project in that state? Or is there anything particular to that state, do you think?
First of all, let me say before I say anything that I love Maine. I love the state. I love where I live here on the West Coast, but if I were to live anywhere else in this country, Maine would be in the top two places. So I got nothing against Maine. However, I don't think it's a salmon versus kingfish thing at all. I really don't. I don't want to say they don't care about salmon, but I don't see that as the issue. The issue is more related to property ownership, property value, long-term wealthy Maine folks who want to preserve things the way they are. I'm not saying that these companies didn't understand that culture, because I'm sure they did. I mean, they did a lot of, Ohad said at one point in one of these stories that they spent a year or more before they even started just kind of researching the permitting process and the locality and on all that. So, but these things have a weird way of taking on an energy, you know, and it may just be you got caught up in, like I said, there's a group kind of pushing all these moratoriums. They had a law firm develop a boilerplate moratorium resolution that any town can bring before its town council or residents or however they do it. And, you know, they're actively going there. It's kind of, I'm going to offend somebody. It's kind of like ambulance chasing, you know, after an accident, you know. So they're going out and trying to get these towns to put up the roadblocks. And the funny thing is, I don't know that the moratoriums would have done anything anyway, because the state really controls the water and a lot of it. So that's still unsettled and unclear. But what it does do is it puts this, it develops this idea, this perception that this is a big issue, that it's big corporations coming in and, you know, stomping on the little town folk and all that.
What I find interesting is that the several of the other projects too across the U.S., have chosen kind of, you know, interesting sort of far-flung locations sometimes. And Aqua Bounty is in Indiana, or building their project in Indiana, I believe. Am I correct on that? I need to fact check myself. But then Nordic Aqua Farms also was working with the city of Humboldt, I believe, as well for a location. And so there must be communities and states there that would be amenable to this kind of development. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense. I think the forward movement of aquaculture in the United States is just so minuscule and has been so small over the entire country's history. And this seems like it's one that has the blessing of environmental NGOs. It's got a really good kind of local production, low carbon emission story to tell. So I find it strange. And you can bring jobs to not just coastal communities, but local communities, very remote communities. I find it odd that more cities and states haven't really jumped on this. Rachel, is there any thoughts as to why we haven't seen efforts in other states?
That's a really good question, actually. I don't know. I think it's, you know, it is still such new technology, and I think, you know, it's just I think there's only so many places these projects can go. I think I've spoken, at least at this point, technology-wise, I think we've spoken with a couple experts on this, and really, you know, the Maine coast and parts of the California coast, maybe there's some other parts in Washington state, and Oregon, but there's not a lot of places these projects can go to. I don't know, depending on the type of project you have, where you can locate it. I know Aqua Bounty is building that facility in Ohio. So yeah, you know, maybe when they get that one going, we can see more how these projects can exist, you know, in the middle of the country. And I know there are a few other projects that also do some land-based stuff in the Midwest that also grow the produce. So, you know, I think we'll get there, but from kind of my years reporting on this, I know the companies that have been wanting to locate in the United States were really pushing to be on one of the coasts. So yeah, we'll kind of have to see if, like, you know, this kind of backlash to some of the projects maybe forces them to be a little more creative with who they talk to, because I'm sure there are some states here in the U.S. that would be more amenable than some of these main communities they're trying to locate in.
But that's the promise, right? That they could put these things anywhere close to larger markets, and, you know, we wouldn't have to fly fish, et cetera, et cetera. I guess it comes down to ultimately a water source, because this is RAS technology. So assuming you have, you know, a decent water source, whether it's from, you know, offshore, you know, offshore, so to speak, off the coast, or whether it's from an aquifer like down in Florida, you should be able to put these pretty much everywhere. And, you know, there's this technology used in shrimp and stuff, and those are scattered and around in the country. There's a shrimp farm in LA. I never knew this, but I learned it the other day or a couple of weeks ago. So I think they can go anywhere. You know, to Brian Vinci's point in his letter, it is still heavy duty technology that nobody has worked out quite yet to do it at scale for market size salmon in this case. So, you know, you need a lot of money. And as you guys mentioned a few minutes ago, lending markets are tight. Some people have argued that Atlantic Sapphire's struggle has soured investors, or at least pushed them into the caution category, you know, as far as these projects are concerned. So there's so many forces coming into play here, but it all looked like it was gonna flourish in Maine, and, you know, here we are. It still might. I don't say that it won't, but I don't think anybody involved in these projects early on expected this is where they would be at this time in the arc of the project. I fully believe they expected to be further down the road and, you know, worrying about how to sell the fish to a retailer rather than how to get a permit from the Jonesport town of Selectman.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that's important to remember too is, although you can put these anywhere close to markets, and that's a big part of the promise, one of the reasons why Maine is so important is when you begin sort of establishing a new industry, you need scale. And the best way to get scale is to have other companies attracted in, other companies doing the same thing in that region. And of course, you have Cook Aquaculture is farming salmon in net pens in Maine. And they're also not too far away with their operations in Canada. And that has a big, big impact on costs, because you need feed, most importantly. You need to have a good, steady source of it. Feed is so expensive that the closer you can get to the feed mills and production, the better off you are. Now, Skretting, which is the world's largest salmon feed producer, they were looking at developing a feed operation in Florida. I think that's still progressing. I don't know exactly where where it sits, but that's the idea is that that would be for Atlantic Sapphire specifically, because its needs would be, assuming that it actually gets to that scale, its needs would be so so big. So maybe it is that it's a bit of that chicken and the egg, and maybe we will see farms go knocking on the door of the city of Homestead, Florida, where Atlantic Sapphire is. So maybe the promise isn't in Maine, but in Florida. I don't know. Moving on to climate change. Joining us today, we have Andrew Mallison. He's a principal of FishThink, a seafood consultancy. Andrew has worked across the seafood sector in certification, in retail, you name it. Andrew, you've been working in all kinds of sectors. So you bring a viewpoint, a kind of a broader viewpoint that I think we need when we're talking about climate change. This week, which is why we decided to talk about this topic, we saw record high temperatures in the UK, in England and in Scotland. There was no immediate impact on the farm salmon that are grown in northern Scotland, but there certainly have been lately impacts in the salmon farming sector, especially down in New Zealand. And of course, we've seen algal blooms, which are related to climate, low oxygen, which is related to climate. So so we've seen a lot of issues both in aquaculture and in fisheries. So, Andrew, we're going to hit on a lot of issues here. But first, just how worried should the industry be about climate change?
Well, it's a great question and obviously very topical. And we should be worried. Climate change is happening and it has momentum. Even if all the governments got their act together, how likely is that? And even if cars suddenly were able to run on water and cows stopped farting, temperatures are going to continue to increase through to at least mid-century. So the changes we're seeing now are going to continue, even if we made some radical changes today, which we're not. So who knows where it quite this is going to land? Certainly change is happening, and I think the challenge to us all is to become aware of it, to plan for it, to be adaptable and resilient. But at least I think others are probably more worried. You know, we have actually some real strengths and things to talk about in the context of climate change. But if you look at land animal farming, and I'm going to pretend that salmon isn't farmed on land at the moment, just for the sake of the discussion. But if you think of the stress on land animal farming about providing animals and livestock with drinking water now, about soil erosion, about irrigation for feed. I was in Utah recently and riding a motorbike, as it happens, and through quite an arid landscape, and I'd see these green patches, and they have massive irrigation arms or booms, I don't know what you call these, this structure, and they would be growing grass for pasture for their beef industry. And the only way that grass is going to grow is if they irrigate it. So I think others are a lot more worried than we are. Let's talk about the opportunities, though, if I may. I think although this animal agriculture sector is probably in the top five main sources of greenhouse gases, depends on which country you're in, but even at a global level, it would be somewhere in that top five. But seafood just spanks the other land-based proteins if you look at their contribution to climate impact versus seafood. People like Ray Hilborn at the University of Washington done some great work on comparisons. The most recent report I saw came from Oceana, which was last September 2021, and again proving the greenhouse gas emissions for seafood are lower than beef. I think it was six times lower compared to beef, but a little less lower, but still lower compared to pork and poultry. So we should be worried. Others are probably more worried. But the flip side of the worry is that we've really got some great talking points when it comes to climate change and how seafood can be a contributor to the solution of mitigating climate impact.
Right. The story is pretty good, as you said, compared with other proteins. So let's talk about, though, mitigating the impacts now. Obviously, you've seen all sides of the aquaculture and fisheries sector. So what species are you most concerned about, both farmed and wild fish, in the coming years as the climate changes?
Okay, well, I guess because of the importance of salmon to aquaculture, that'd have to be the species you'd be most worried about. As you mentioned earlier, that we're already seeing sites that have been traditionally operated, cage sites offshore, becoming inoperable because of algal blooms or because of temperature increase. And I think from memory, Atlantic salmon doesn't do very well over sort of 14 degrees centigrade. So inevitably there's a threat there. And that's going to have an impact, because finding more sites, just moving things up the coast if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, or further south if you're in the south, is not usually an option because it's harder to find coastal sites now. The land side is a little bit more resilient to temperature, but is not yet established and also has big energy demands. So it's not the ideal and easy alternative. So I think salmon is the one to watch, but all of them will have impacts. And I think some forward planning as to, well, where is this fish going to be grown if you project what the local water temperature is going to be? The things like crustacea, probably more resilient because they're a warm water species anyway. But those cold water species that are in our top five are the biggies. If you look at the wild side, I think we're already seeing a shift in distribution of catch. You know, if you go along most coasts, you could probably see that more warmer habitat species are starting to appear in catches. We're sort of familiar with that. It's already causing big problems with migration routes. You probably remember the arguments between Iceland and Norway and Scotland about mackerel, because right. The mackerel was swinging a bit further north than they were supposed to. Obviously, nobody told them. somebody did tell them, they didn't listen. But, you know, where are these traditional fisheries going to be if their migration routes start to shift into different jurisdictions? And there's some other more subtle impacts, like predators. You know, apparently there was some research I saw from the National Science Foundation, came out in May this year. Interestingly, how predators are slower to respond to climate change and temperature change than lower trophic level species that they prey on. So we might find things like anchoveta and herring and sprat and some of these small sardine-like stocks move further north, and the predators are then left without a food supply because they're not quite as adaptive or quick to respond, because they have longer life cycles potentially. Tuna may be affected, for example, if it doesn't really have its prey resource where it used to be. So that's a bit of a concern. And there's also the biology of the wild fish. You know, if warmer water in the spring for spring spawning stocks, if that triggers spawning earlier, that might mean larvae hatch out before their food supply is ready to be consumed. So larval supply and survival might be prejudiced. So there's a bunch, and that's just off the top of my head sort of thing, there's a bunch of things that potentially would threaten wild fish in its availability, in its species range, and obviously the jurisdiction, the fishery management aspect of it.
Right. And I think the hardest part here is when you hear, it can be overwhelming to hear all of these issues and, you know, and just think about all these changes that are going to happen both in the short and long term. But to what extent do you think this is that the industry is even thinking about these things? Because again, I think for all of us, it just feels so big. It feels difficult to know kind of on an individual level what you can do to prepare. And I can imagine if you're a $2-10 billion company, it's even more complex. So is this something just in your conversations with the industry that people are thinking and talking enough about, or is it just kind of an issue to kick down the road a bit?
I think it varies. You know, as an industry, we're not the most joined up. We're quite fragmented. There's lots of different interest groups, you know, by fishing method or by region. You know, there's not a lot of global cohesion, particularly on the wild fish side. So I think there's an awareness. The bigger companies are doing something about it. And the first thing to do is to work out what your impact is. And you're probably aware that it's been going for maybe 5 or 6 years now, but there's a protein sustainability report that a group called Collar Fair, F-A-I-R-R, produce. And the most recent one in 2021 is now up to about 60 companies across all sorts of proteins, land-based and aquaculture and fishing. So it's great to see out of all of the, and the index is made up of a number of things about the greenhouse gas emissions, but also waste and other contributors to sustainability. And MOE came first in the 2021 report, and GREE came second. So two aquaculture companies leading the world, or at least the 60 companies who joined it. And there were big companies, people like Tyson, you know, a poultry producer in the USA, mega companies. And aquaculture is coming out on top as the leaders in the sustainability. And they're doing it by people like MOE producing their reports, measuring their impacts. But there's still a bit of an impediment in as much as methodology is. It's getting a bit more agreed now, but there's still some variability in, well, how actually do you measure impact? How actually do you measure this? And I was really impressed that the Aquaculture Stewardship Council have got a project going to try and establish a methodology for greenhouse gas calculation in aquaculture. So the answer to your question, I say there's some, but not enough. We need more transparency, more reporting. And I think there's a start, but people need to really be aware that this is their business for the future, and their business continuity is going to rely on this for the next couple of decades.
Right. Are you seeing technological shifts in aquaculture or fisheries that you think can make a difference, or companies that are doing anything specifically that you think is a step in the right direction?
Yeah, I think so. In broad terms, technology, rephrase that. We need science to be able to understand this pressure, this climate pressure. Science needs data. And I think generally the industry is getting better at collecting data. Sensor technology is better available. And I think this is probably more used in the aquaculture sector than wild fish, although net data and sensors are more used. People like Clearwater in Canada have been using seabed scanning sonars to be really targeted about their trawling operations for some time. So I think it's out there, and I think there's more interest in the uptake of it as it becomes cheaper. And then as you have sensor technology developing to collect all of this data, you've got artificial intelligence at the same time also developing a pace to try and make sense of that data. So I think if we can find, industry can find these solutions, they're emerging, they need support, they need trialing, they need feedback loops to make the product better. I think the bête noire is going to be genetic modification, because of course if you had genetically modified salmon, they wouldn't be so sensitive to temperature change potentially. And I know this is what Aqua Bounty is looking at. So yeah, that becomes a bit more contentious, but I think there is technology out there that is useful already by some companies, but it again needs to get further distributed and used up.
You know, I know there is a selective breeding project that's been going on with a company in Australia, Patuna, for just that exact issue, to try to breed a salmon that can tolerate some of these higher temperatures. So, as you said, it's going to be science and, of course, money as well. And I think that's one you see Salmar, a major salmon farming company, and Aker, is a large conglomerate across a lot of ocean industries, joining up to do an offshore aquaculture operation. I think it's kind of those big bold steps, right? That I think we're gonna need to see more of. But as you said, science, and then I think that other component is investment. And I think that's where companies then begin to question how much time, effort, and attention they should put into climate mitigation for their companies, or climate preparation, maybe we should say. But if you're to give some advice on what companies should be doing practically to prepare to be more aware of what changes are going to happen to their business, what would be your guidance?
Well, I guess it depends where they're starting from, but let's say that it's pretty much a blank sheet of paper, because the Coller Fair report was saying more people are reporting now, but still there's quite a gap. So I guess the first thing would be to upskill yourself, to recruit, to train, to understand the issue, whether you use consultancy, whether you use your in-house people, your choice. But you have to have that resource available to understand the implications and have it at a sufficiently senior level. And it's interesting to see how many companies now have chief sustainability officers. I think the seafood sector is a little bit slow to come to this party. I know American Seafoods recruited one last year to do that. But certainly climate change is a big threat, needs to be understood. And once you've got the capacity to understand it, you've then got to establish your links to the science. There's a lot of science, there's a lot of consultation going on as to what is this common methodology that everybody's going to use and be judged by. So let's have a one hymn sheet to be talking from, and then organize. You know, this affects us all, and it should be seen as a pre-competitive thing. You know, you can't have one company saying, well, you know, we can't do anything because our competitors might find out about it. There has to be some understanding that it is pre-competitive. It'll affect everybody. The rising tide floats or sinks or boats. And once you've got that, hopefully that's going to be probably one of the biggest steps for us to achieve, because we're a pretty fractious bunch, and we haven't got a great track record of collaboration. But if we can somehow pull together on that, then the next thing would be to communicate the benefits of seafood, how we are not reliant so much on fresh water, how we don't cause soil erosion, how we have very, very low, particularly wild fish, very low greenhouse gas emissions. All these benefits that should hopefully persuade government to give the industry more support, hopefully support the financial sector to give the industry more support. So communicate and influence would be the last part of it. But government and the financial sector are not, well, they're going to struggle if they're hearing 100 voices. You know, we need to try and speak with one voice, and some convening is going to be required, particularly on the wild side.
Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
And that wraps up this episode of the IntraFish Podcast. Remember that you can find our work 24/7 on intrafish.com, where we're covering aquaculture, fisheries, aquatech, seafood processing, and more. You can sign up for our newsletters there. If you're a subscriber, you can get alerts on your favorite topics or companies or people. So visit us there, intrafish.com. You can also get our headlines on our new app. And of course, you can find our podcast, which you obviously already have found, but you can subscribe to us on iTunes, on Spotify, and on Google Play, so that when new episodes do come out, they come directly to your cell phone. Thanks, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time.